I call Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, March 9th, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Committee members with me today is Senator Rauscher, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Myers, Senator Dunbar, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, and I'm Senator Giesel. Online is Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and Chloe, who are keeping the minutes for us and running the audio. We have three items on today's agenda. So first of all, Senate Joint Resolution 26, Support Native Corporation Business Development Program. That'll be followed by Senate Bill 253, Sulfur Content of Marine Fuel. And lastly, Senate Bill 224, Public Land Sale, Lease, Commercial Development. So today we're taking up, to start out, Senate Joint Resolution 26. This is the second hearing. The last time this was before the committee, we had invited and public testimony. An amendment deadline was set for this resolution for last Wednesday at noon. We received no amendments. So a brief recap of the bill, of the resolution, please. My staff, Paige Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Paige Brown, staff to Senator Kathy Giesel. SJR 26 expresses the Alaska Legislature's support for maintaining Alaska Native Corporation and tribally owned business participation in the federal 8A Business Development Program. The resolution recognizes that the program has been an important tool for Alaska Native corporations created under ANCSA to generate economic opportunity, create jobs, and reinvest in Alaska communities. SJR 26 communicates Alaska's position during ongoing federal review of the 8A program and affirms that continued participation by Alaska Native corporations and tribal entities supports workforce development and economic stability across the state.
Very good. Thank you. Are there any questions from committee members related to the resolution? Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, but just a comment I didn't make last time this was before us. I don't have an economic interest or any conflict to declare because I no longer work in this space, but I did for a number of years. I worked as an attorney for Chugach Government Solutions, which is part of Chugach Alaska, the regional corporation, and we did almost exclusively 8A contracting. And I think it's an illustration of the wide-ranging economic benefits that this program has in Alaska. It's not just shareholders of these corporations. It's lots of folks in Anchorage, in rural areas. And so I'm glad that this resolution is coming forward, and I intend to support it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Further questions or comments? All right. Seeing none, Senator Wilikowski.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Joint Resolution 26, version 34-LS1420/N, as in Nikiski, from committee with individual recommendations and attached sterile fiscal note. Legislative legal has the authority to make any technical and conforming changes.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, Senate Joint Resolution 26, version N, will move from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note. We'll sign the documents before we adjourn today, or after we adjourn today. We'll move right on now to Senate Bill 253, Sulfur Content of Marine Fuel. Welcome to Senator Jesse Keel, here to present the bill, along with Ella Atkinson, his staff. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Senate Resources Committee. I appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill today. For your record, my name is Jesse Keel. I have the privilege of serving as a senator for Senate District B. Madam Chair, Senate Bill 253 is another in a long line of examples where in Alaska we support a strong economy and doing development right. We have a great history of doing that when it comes to the shipping industry. Back in the late 1990s and early 2000s, DEC discovered that some of the wastewater treatment on cruise ships didn't operate the way everybody thought it operated. The state of Alaska made new rules. The industry made substantial investments, and Alaska's wastewater standards for large ships, especially cruise ships, led the world until most of the rest of the world caught up. Plug-in shore power for cruise ships originated, at least on this continent, right here in Juneau. And ports around America and around the world have added shore power plugins. The industry has invested, and a whole lot of really big engines are idled or even turned off, and they call it, I think, cold iron, when they're in port using shore power. In 2012, an emissions control area, and this wasn't an Alaska move, but an emissions control area went into effect for much of the west coast of North America, including Alaska, and it was aimed at air quality. And it was aimed at the emissions from very, very large engines on very big ships. One of the ways that some shipping lines, some organizations, were able to comply with that emissions control area was by switching over from the heavy fuel oil, some people use the term bunker fuel, that a lot of those ships burned, to distilled fuels, marine gas oil being the most common of those that had a very low, much lower sulfur content. Another way that some ships, some shipping companies met those new standards was what are called scrubbers. And I will radically oversimplify them because I am not the guy with a science degree, but in essence, a mist of water comes down through what would be the plume of exhaust, and that water captures sulfur, it captures soot, it captures other things, and then is dealt with one of two ways. Sometimes that water is captured on board the ship. It is pretty dirty at that point, pretty sludgy, and it is held and disposed of as hazardous material on shore later. Other times, that water is diluted heavily and pumped overboard or below the waterline, but pumped to the ocean. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the more we have learned about what is in the heavy fuel oil and what goes overboard from those scrubbers that do discharge that water, the more concerning it has become. Senate Bill 253 would have Alaska take the next step when it comes to those discharges into Alaska's environment. Let's be clear. The most harmful thing we could do with high sulfur fuel and the emissions from burning high sulfur fuel is put it in the air. We don't do that anymore. The next step, however, is another route into Alaska's environment where it goes into our water. Along with the sulfur, I mentioned the soot. We sometimes hear that called black carbon or particulate matter. It's soot to the rest of us. Burning the high sulfur, the heavy fuel oil, also generates a lot of other chemicals. PAHs are is the initialism for polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. They're a waste product. They're a byproduct. The scrubbers do take them out of the air. But then they put them in the water. They're extremely bad for marine life. Along with those, the heavy fuel oil contains a lot of metals that have harmful effects when discharged into our environment. It's a fair amount of arsenic. There's some cadmium, chromium, and copper. They're all useful in their own places, but they don't belong in Alaska's waters or air. This is not a conspiracy. This is not an evil plot. This is just what's in heavy fuel oil. I think it's worth taking a moment just to explain to the public, when crude oil is refined, a lot of fuels are distilled off. You take the lightest, thinnest stuff first. So you get your gasoline and then your kerosene and your jet fuel. And as you get heavier and more more viscous, you'll get the marine gas oil that a lot of ships use to comply with the low sulfur standards. You get diesel fuels, lubricant oils. But once you've taken that off, what you're left with is basically bunker fuel, this heavy fuel oil, and asphalt. You're down to the proverbial bottom of the barrel. As a result, it's pretty cheap, but it's extremely viscous. It's got a lot of stuff left in it that didn't distill off with those other high-value fuels. And it's pretty bad if it spills. It's got a lot of toxic stuff in it. So it's not just the hydrocarbon that you need to provide power and drive a ship forward. And that's why Senate Bill 253. Heavy fuel oil is not something that Alaskans can use. It's got to be heated up to be burned. It's that thick and viscous. It needs a really big cylinder. Our largest Alaska Marine Highway System ferry, the Columbia, 418 foot long. She's got 14,000 horses. Her engines aren't big enough to burn heavy fuel oil. It's also important to note that it's illegal for Alaskans to use high sulfur fuels. You can't put it in your pickup truck. You can't put it in a Peterbilt. You can't put it in a tugboat or a gillnetter engine. Alaskans have to use low sulfur diesel fuel, and gasoline standards are even lower. So Senate Bill 253 doesn't propose any standards more stringent than what Alaskans themselves and Alaska businesses do every day. Let me switch in my notes here. By removing heavy fuel oil from the shipping supply chain, from the shipping industry in Alaska, we are helping to do development right, helping to do it right in Alaska's shipping economy and Alaska's tourism economy. I think it's worth noting that there are a couple of exemptions in the bill. It's not a blanket ban in all cases. Ships in innocent passage, making it through the Great Circle route that never stop in Alaska waters, are not subject to this bill. Ships that call in only one port are not subject to this bill. In that way, we target the areas of most environmental concern, our inside waters, places where Alaskans fish, where Alaskans gather shellfish or seaweed, where Alaskans, where the resulting emissions from heavy fuel oil would impact our land, our air, our water. Madam Chair, I mentioned earlier that there are two ways for the precipitate from these so-called scrubber systems to be dealt with. The bill carves out an exception for ships that capture that water and later dispose of it outside Alaska. And here we're talking about putting it ashore in drums as hazmat. If it's not discharged to Alaska's environment, the bill isn't concerned with it. I know that's controversial with some folks, but I think in terms of getting at the actual problem, this matters. It's worth noting, Madam Chair, that there are a lot of folks who have done this already. Some of the tankers that ply Alaska water burn low sulfur diesel fuels or marine gas oil. Some of the container vessels that call on the Port of Anchorage, or excuse me, the Don Young Port of Alaska in Anchorage, I'll get it right one of these days, are burning LNG. There are some tourism industry vessels that voluntarily burn only the very low sulfur marine gas oil. Some run heavy fuel oil but use their scrubbers in closed loop mode today. Senate Bill 253 would take the rest of the shipping industry, whether cargo or cruise or what have you, who ply our most important, most heavily used waters, the waters most heavily used by Alaskans, to that same standard. With that, Madam Chair, we have a couple of invited testifiers. I'm also happy to take questions from the committee.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Committee members, questions for the bill sponsor?
Actually, who's?
Senator Kawasaki.
I just wanted to know who was online to be able to answer questions.
Yes.
Maybe apply the questions.
Online. Hold on. Let me get to that one. There it is. So online for questions. I have Jean McCabe, Director, Division of Water, Department of Environmental Conservation. I have Jason Olds. He's also Director, Division of Air Quality at DEC. And Craig Tornga, Marine Director, Alaska Marine Highway System. And then Valerie Chatterley, Environmental Compliance, Air and Water Quality Consultant, Carnival. But I believe she is invited testimony. So she's just invited testimony. So that's who's online.
Okay. Then.
Do you have a question then,
Senator Kosa? Yeah, I guess this would be the senator or staff is just, so what kind of a difference in cost are we talking about when we talk about making a, or putting this sort of fuel requirement? And then I think for further research, it would be nice to know which ones use the scrubber type systems that are closed looped, which ones use the one that are open loop currently, just sort of just to understand like what's the universe of potentials out there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, Senator Keel, the different shippers have different fuel rates from different suppliers. There are analyses from some folks in the advocacy community that suggest the marine gas oil costs about 1.5 times what heavy fuel oil costs. I've also had conversations with folks in industry who say it's closer to twice. So in terms of who uses what, I'm not particularly inclined to name names in a committee hearing. I'm happy to have conversations offline. I think it is worth just reflecting. You have testimony, written testimony in the bill materials from an operator of cargo ships, container ships. They say they have a scrubber that can run in closed loop mode on their ships. And then I believe in the very large cruise vessel market, of the 31 ships that called in Alaska last year, I think 19 of them do not either already use low sulfur fuels or have the closed loop option available.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Keel, you brought up, I don't know if this is who you're alluding to, but in our bill packet, we have a letter from Mattson opposing this bill. But reading your bill here, subsection B on page 2, about calling only in one port, it would seem to me that this would exempt Mattson in most cases. And maybe I'm not as familiar with their operations as you are. I was under the impression they came from out of state, went to the Port of Alaska at Anchorage, and then left the state. But perhaps do they make another call in Juneau? Is that why they are concerned? Or does this exemption not exempt Mattson?
Madam Chair, in answer to Senator Dunbar's question, they would be best to speak for themselves. My understanding is that at least some of their cargo container operations do also stop in Kodiak.
Mm.
I would note that they had concern that sub D, which lets DEC give an exemption to a vessel that captures their scrubber wash and offloads it outside Alaska. I think that letter said their concern is with the word may exempt. That's something that I would submit to the committee if that's a concern to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Senator Myers.
Thank you. On that point, so let's say we've got a cargo container vessel that's heading up the inside passage. I'm curious as to why we would want the single port exemption. The no port exemption is somebody's traveling through. That makes sense. We've got no reason to stop them or inspect them. You know, we don't have jurisdiction. But you know, whether a container ship stops at Haines or it stops at Juneau and Haines, it's still in state waters. It's still hitting a state port. It's still putting out the same pollution as it's motoring its way on up. So why would we put in the one port exemption?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. In response to Senator Myers, the tug and barge operations that bring containers up and down the inside passage, those tugs don't have engines big enough to burn heavy fuel oil.
Okay.
Follow up, Senator Myers?
I was trying to use that as just one example, but you know, regardless of whether it stops at, you know, as you mentioned, Anchorage and then Kodiak and then back down to Seattle, or it just stops at Anchorage, it's still in state waters, it's still burning the same fuel. So why are we still doing the one port exemption?
Madam Chair, in response to Senator Myers, the the goal of the bill really is to protect the areas where Alaskans the way we live and the way we make our livelihoods can be most impacted, can be most affected. For the same reason that the international organizations limited the emissions control area to nearshore waters in much of North America, but not to the wide open ocean as you cross the Gulf of Alaska or across the North Pacific. And so when we look at some of the inside waters, some of the estuarine waters, we have situations, first and foremost, where Alaskans catch a lot of fish. We gather a lot of shellfish. We gather seaweed, where we gather land plants and hunt, where we play, where we boat. The cleanliness of those waters matters the most. They're also not the kind of areas where those where the scrubbers were designed really to operate. You've got freshwater lenses on top of the salt water and limited mixing in those inside areas. And so when you look at vessel traffic in those areas, that's where we're concerned. Vessels in innocent passage, vessels simply going in and out, spend so little time and have so little impact in a single port situation. By and large, these are very, very large vessels, and so they're transiting the open ocean waters almost all the time. I don't believe you will find the cargo ships, the container ships headed for anchorage, trying to pick their way up through Chatham Strait and steer clear of some of the difficult points and treacherous currents, especially if you got to make a left at Icy and try and get out Lysianski. It's rough sometimes. So those vessels are transiting, by and large, the open ocean rather than the inside waters.
Follow-up, Senator Myers.
Yeah, so I guess that brings up another point, which is it feels like this bill is, in some ways, it's kind of duplicating jurisdiction. If the federal government and the international group that gives us the emission control area is already regulating this and already saying this is what we want, why are we duplicating effort?
Madam Chair, the North American Emissions Control Area is really focused only on air quality. It doesn't take into consideration the impact of what then gets discharged to the water. The goal of Senate Bill 253 is all of what gets discharged in Alaska.
Okay. All right. I see no further questions. So, Senator Rauscher, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, so what are the different type of vessels we are talking about that this bill will affect?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In answer to Senator Rauscher, we will be looking primarily – there was mention earlier of some of the container ships that call on multiple Alaska ports. As I said, I believe one of those companies, Burns LNG, another of those has the ability to qualify for the closed loop exemption or permit. And then we're looking also at the large cruise vessels. And among those, the largest, some of the smaller cruise ships don't have large enough vessels to install a scrubber. And so they've been burning the distilled low sulfur marine gas oil for many years.
Do you have follow-up, Senator Rauscher?
Yeah, and so approximately how many vehicles, ships are we talking about? Do you have any idea what we're talking about? Just trying to get the size of the nature of the problem.
Madam Chair, in answer to Senator Rauscher's question, I know that of the 31 large cruise vessels that plied Alaska's waters last year, I believe there are 19 that run the open loop scrubbers or do not have a closed loop option available to them. And then I believe we've covered the universe of large container vessels. And my understanding is that the oil tankers that ply Cook Inlet waters and could potentially stop at two terminals already burn low sulfur fuel.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Senator Kawasaki, and then we do need to get to invited testimony. Yeah. Senator Kawasaki.
Just one really brief question is, is low-sulfur diesel or low-sulfur fuels prevalent and available at like every gas station. I mean, every place where every port where one of these ships would be.
Madam Chair, to answer Senator Kawasaki's question, there is substantial capacity for ships to take on marine gas oil, which is usually the preferred option. They can take enough of that on board in Seattle or Vancouver to make their Alaska transits with room to spare. I will have to get back to the committee with locations where a vessel might be able to take on marine gas oil in state. I don't have that answer today.
Thank you.
Very good. So with that, we will go to invited testimony. I have two folks here in the room. Dr. Stanley Rice, Professor Emeritus, thank you, Emeritus, University of Alaska Fairbanks. And he will be followed by Maggie Rabb, who is the executive director of SEAC. Dr. Rice, welcome. Dr. Rice, in light of the fact that we have four invited testimony altogether and a second bill, I'm going to limit invited testimony to 5 minutes each.
Okay.
So, welcome. If you would identify yourself for the record.
My name's Stanley Rice. I guess that's it. I've been in Juneau since 1971 when I was hired to initiate an oil spill effects program for NOAA at the Auk Bay Fisheries Laboratory. And so I got involved then. I have a dissertation, so I've got a PhD. And because my dissertation involved toxicity and physiology of developing trout embryos, I had an expertise that allowed me to basically hire chemists and hire biologists to set up this team. And we did research for a number of years. We produced quite a few publications, and so we were placed when the 1989 oil spill, Exxon Valdez spill, occurred. And our team had basically the only chemists within the agencies that were involved, and that was at a time when so there's a lot of expertise, like in fish and game on salmon and herring, but they didn't have chemists. So we basically partnered with quite a few different groups. So I've got publications, for example, on all sorts of stuff, pink salmon, embryos, herring, my team does, and all the way up to killer whales and sea otters. So we kind of ran the gamut of all sorts of things. I'll skip the rest and get right down to some nitty-gritty. So basically, when the oil spill occurred in 89, there is a paradigm. That means the assumptions that kind of governed overall thinking of how oil spills would cause an effect and that sort of thing. And that paradigm was that you had to worry about acute toxicity. And that, of course, was based on the oil spill contaminating birds and sea otters, anything that breathed on the surface, it would kill, and they would be on the shoreline, and the carcasses would be picked up, and that's how damages were really assessed back in the old days, so to speak. Well, Alaska is very pristine, as you all well know, and so the spill occurred in a pristine area, and so it just got an awful lot of attention. It, of course, was a record spill at that time, the largest spill in U.S. waters at that time. And so we went looking for stuff. I had a crew of chemists up sampling underneath oil slick, and within about 8-9 days of the initiation of the spill, and I had a crew up there evaluating size and growth of pink salmon fry as they emerged out of Port Valdez hatchery, and also wild streams on the corridor as they exited Prince William Sound, had those up and operating within about 30, 35 days or so. So we had lots of initial experience. Initially, the expected things, as we'll call them, the acute mortalities like sea otters, birds, there's hundreds of thousands of birds killed and thousands of sea otters. So there's lots of dead carcasses and lots of mileage, beaches, et cetera, to evaluate. And so the expected things were found, and what was unexpected are things that kind of started popping up and appearing as the research grew in maturity over the next several years. An example, I'll get right to a couple of four examples. Killer whales was a big surprise. So there are two pods of killer whales in Prince William's. Well, there's several pods of killer whales, but two of them in Prince William Sound were affected. 8AB1, which is a fish-eating pod, had a 40% mortality over the next year or two. And 8T1, a transient pod, also had 40% mortality. And the upshot, and that was from acute exposure. That's from those animals surfacing in an oil slick and inhaling. And if you hold your breath and exhale, which is what they did immediately, then you have to breathe. So you're taking in fumes that are literally within a foot or two of the surface of the water. So they inhale stuff and probably got lung damage. Bad news is there's no carcasses that were autopsied. None were found, but the numbers were documented. And this is one of the best studies done. It had photo IDs for 4 years prior to the spill and then continued afterwards. Documented well who was missing. And those acute mortalities were significant. And the recovery rate of AB pod was slow. It's been 30 years almost. And they're not fully recovered yet. And that's because some females were affected. Their longevity is 50, 60, 70 years. Females only have 5, 6, 7 calves in their lifetime. So recovery rate is not like a pink salmon that has 2,500 eggs in any one spawning. So the AT pod was also hit equally hard, but the one catch is none of the females survived. So it has no potential to recover. And as the elders die off, the pod keeps smaller and will achieve extinction in a few years. The next study I want to highlight is the pink salmon study. And this is a groundbreaking study. Fish and Game does normal egg assessments in order to manage the pink salmon fishery there. And so they go out and pump streams in a random way that's extremely statistical and nerdy. I'll say that, even though the work is literally rubber boots and that sort of thing. And they detected elevated embryo mortalities in a number of streams that were oiled at the mouths, but the stream itself did not have oil in it, but the banks were coated with oil. And up to 75% of the population of pink salmon in Prince William Sound come from the intertidal zone, and every other year anyway. And they detected elevated mortalities, and they didn't quite know why, because like I say, the streams, as you walk the streams, they were clean. Fresh water kept coming down. Well, the catch is at high tide, then as the tide goes out, the water-laden sediments, which had oil, would seep down into those spawning gravels and affected the mortalities. The mechanism was a little bit vague. They didn't do that sort of thing. They just quantified the slow recovery as the elevated mortalities drifted down for 4 years and finally became equal to the control streams. That stimulated a study from our laboratory where we exposed pink salmon embryos for their freshwater life history to very low doses in the parts per billion. Acute bioassays are normally in the parts per million, so a part per billion is three orders or 1,000 times less than a part per million. So we were exposing them to very low doses. And we could get, if we had the dose high enough, like say 40 or 50 parts per billion, we could cause mortalities and we could cause abnormalities, curved spines and that sort of thing. But we're really interested in why is the number of embryos affected. And so we did this over a number of years, and we kept increasing the complexity and sophistication of the experiment. We eventually were tagging exposing 75,000 embryos to a certain dose, 75,000 to a control. We had several different doses, and then tagging them with a wire tag in their nose and an adipose clip on their fin so that we could identify the adults when they returned. And the net result is that 5 parts per billion to the embryos, an extremely low dose. I mean, you can't see that dose. It would cause a 20% reduction in adult returns. And an 18 part per billion would cause a 40% reduction. Well, 40% reduction, that's going to get you to extinction levels pretty quick if that were the case.
Dr. Rice?
Yeah.
I've let you go well past
the time
limit. And so I'll ask you to relate this to the bill briefly.
Okay. I had two more issues.
I do understand, but we have other people as well.
I got it. But I'll relate it. And basically, all of this is PAHs, of course. And you heard Senator Keel talk about the PAHs in the discharge of the cruise ship. So my point is that the bottom line, I'll say, is that you don't have to cruise ships are not going to cause acute mortalities. You're not going to see dead things on the beach or that sort of thing. But the discharges could have an impact on pink salmon embryos, on herring eggs, on the larva, on crab larvae, et cetera. All those are going to overlap in time with the cruise industry. And so if you had a large volume of discharge over a long period of time, you're at risk to affecting those sorts of early life stages.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Just a really brief question, if you could. So if there was, you mentioned if there was a large volume, if there's a small volume over a long period of time, is that the same impact to the fisheries or to the organisms in that water column? And then how easy is it to clean up, or does it bioaccumulate within?
Well, one thing about bunker oil, I do have experience with a Kuroshima spill. Bunker oils, as the Senator said, have these very heavy compounds, which used to be thought of, well, those are carcinogenic. That's all we have to worry about. It's not really toxic to the physiology of a developing animal. Wrong. They can be absorbed with contact, and they're not very biodegradable. The heavier you get larger in size of the chemical compound, that means heavier. That means the harder it is for bacteria to degrade, the harder it is for it to dissolve, harder for it to disappear, and basically for the environment to recover. So a little bit over a long period of time will still kind of accumulate. It's not like DDT that once it gets in you, it's forever there, but it's very hard to get rid of by the organism and by bacteria.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Rice. Also here in the room is Maggie Rapp. Maggie is the executive director of SEAC, which I will let you uncode that abbreviation, that acronym.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Maggie Rabb. I was born here in Juneau. I come from a commercial fishing family, and I am the executive director of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, or SEAC. SEAC has a 55-year history of being a community-led conservation organization working on environmental concerns in Southeast Alaska. We first started looking at cruise ships because community members were coming to us and sharing concerns about water and air pollution that they were seeing from ships. And we were surprised to learn that cruise ships weren't actually required to burn the same fuel that my husband's commercial fishing boat or our ferry boats use. And they are actually, many of them, still burning dirty heavy fuel oil, which is creating additional air pollution and water pollution that is unnecessary. As Senator Keel said, heavy fuel oil, or HFO, is a byproduct of the distillation process, of the refinery process. It's a thick, heavy, viscous substance, and it's full of toxics like sulfur, metals, and long-form hydrocarbons. Even with even with an exhaust gas scrubber, the use of heavy fuel oil actually creates more air pollution. So even though they are required to run the exhaust through a scrubber to legally burn it because of the high sulfur content, it actually creates more air pollution, additional particulate matter, and black carbon, which is an acute climate-causing, climate-generating pollutant that melts glaciers. It's also tied to cancer-causing diseases, cardiovascular disease, and respiratory illness. HFO also poses an additional persistent fuel oil spill risk. Because it doesn't disperse and evaporate like many oils, it actually lingers in the environment longer. It can sink and then be turned up and recoat beaches over long periods of time. So it can essentially smother and coat habitats and beaches repeatedly. It's also, even though we're putting these things through scrubbers, the exhaust is actually not cleaner. If we remember that the pollutants that I mentioned, they aren't removed from the environment completely. They're transferred from the air to the water. And so what we're doing is we are running the exhaust through these machines, these scrubbers, and you're spraying it down with fresh water, and you're creating concentrated water pollution. And the majority of these cruise ships then water that down with additional fresh water added and dump it overboard. Some studies have found that the wastewater from the scrubber process is actually harmful to the development of key critical species like sea urchins and blue mussels in their larval stage, even at extremely low concentrations, which the professor was just referencing. So to be clear, they're not removing the pollution, they're moving the source. But also, they don't even manage that well. So SEAC did a study of data from 2 years of self-reporting. 18 cruise ships self-reported to the EPA that they violated the very minimal standards that they're required to meet 700 times in Alaska waters in 2023 and 2024. They're required to water down the wastewater before they have to dilute it, before they discharge it, and they self-reported 700 violations of not meeting those standards. Simply using cleaner fuel removes all of these problems. And the other thing to note is that they don't have to change the technology to do so. These ships are all carrying HFO and cleaner marine fuels at the same time, and they switch back and forth because there are restrictions on where you can use HFO. So they have to be able to switch back and forth. But why do they do it? It is cheaper. We asked experienced economists to help us understand how much it would cost to switch to a cleaner fuel here in Alaskan waters. They used data from the Alaska Marine Exchange and from the EPA to do estimates of how much fuel is being used and what the cost would be. They found that almost 97% of all HFO use in Alaska waters is by the cruise industry. So this is a cruise problem. And they found that the cost of switching to the cleaner marine fuel in Alaska waters would be about $3.50 per passenger per day, so about a cup of coffee. And for reference, Carnival's net income last year was $3.1 billion. Requiring cleaner fuel is not a threat to the cruise industry in Alaska. Alaska is also not alone in taking on this issue. More than 50 countries have passed some sort of restriction on cleaner fuels or scrubbers. California has a requirement on cleaner fuels within 24 nautical miles. The state of Washington is considering legislation on this issue. And even here in Alaska, the use of heavy fuel oil is not allowed in Glacier Bay. It's been banned from the Arctic. And cruise ships often tell us that they voluntarily choose not to use it in ports. If it's not good enough for Glacier Bay and for the Arctic and for our ports, they don't use it in Gastineau Channel, then it's not good enough for our state waters.
I'll ask you to wrap up.
Our preferred gold standard option would be to require cleaner fuel use across the board. This legislation is a step in the right direction, but we don't feel it does enough to address all of the issues that HFO poses with the increased spill risk, additional air pollution, and the water pollution created by cleaning the scrubbers. But we're here to work towards a better solution for our Alaska waters, and we really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Myers, question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So the bill's talking about sulfur. Mm-hmm. You're talking about a whole lot of other things. I don't think you personally, I don't think you mentioned sulfur. I'm curious if that's, if sulfur's not the primary problem, then what really should we be addressing here and what do we need to change?
Yeah, we could simply ban the use of heavy fuel oil, which is full of sulfur, and this bill does target that. But we could also just identify which fuels we find acceptable.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your testimony. Yeah. We have two more folks wishing to testify, and they are on the phone. One is Donnie Brown. Donnie, can you hear us?
I have you loud and clear, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you. If you would identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, I am limiting to 5 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Donald Brown. I'm the Senior Vice President for Maritime Policy with Cruise Lines International Association, representing the Global Ocean Cruise Line members that sail to Alaska. We appreciate the legislature's efforts to reduce emissions, improve air quality, and protect the marine environment. We do, however, have strong concerns regarding this bill as currently drafted. CLIA members are investing tens of billions of dollars in ships with environmental technologies designed to reduce emissions and improve environmental performance. International maritime emission standards are established through the IMO, International Maritime Organization, and vessels operating in Alaska waters are already required to comply with the North America Emission Control Area, the ECA, which mandates that the same 0.1% sulfur limit referenced in this bill. Cruise lines fully comply with these requirements as implemented by the United States through the use of compliant fuels, through the uptake of emerging alternative fuels, and the use of authorized equivalent technologies that achieve the same or better emission reduction results. Exhaust gas cleaning systems, which this bill could effectively prohibit, are recognized as equivalent compliance solutions under international regulations and are approved by ship administrations worldwide. Many ships use these systems to meet the stringent emission requirements of the North America ECA, including in Alaskan waters. Because these standards are already comprehensively regulated under MARPOL Annex 6 and implemented in the United States through the Federal Act to prevent pollution from ships, rather than advancing new environmental protections, this bill duplicates existing regulations and constrains operators from using lawful, innovative technologies. Although the bill is drafted as a state codification of sulfur limits, its practical impact could create uncertainty for many ships and operators that rely on internationally recognized equivalent technologies. In particular, this bill does not explicitly recognize exemptions for any equivalent technologies, such as EGCS, which are authorized by MARPOL, operate within strict standards established under MARPOL and the EPA Vessel General Permit, and the EPA's Vessel Incidental Discharge Act framework, which incorporates IMO guidelines into the U.S. regulatory framework. As drafted, the bill attempts to legislate restrictions of those technologies without the benefit of appropriate data, scientific evaluation, or risk assessment. The 2022 IMO guidelines provide a clear outline on how to do that with risk and impact assessment guidance. These provide the methodologies and science-based evaluation process, and they specifically outline how jurisdictions can assess potential impacts to specific waterways before imposing restrictions. We recommend that Alaska rely on this internationally recognized process before adopting any measure. An IMO resolution also states that the solid residue generated by exhaust gas cleaning systems must not be discharged at sea and should instead be retained on board for proper disposal shoreside. CLIA members adhere to these practices. International shipping depends on consistent global standards established through the IMO, duplicative requirements risk unnecessary and confusing patchworks of regulations layered on top of harmonized systems. The duplicative regulation creates significant challenges for ships and complicates fuel flexible operations and the industry's transition towards next generation low and zero carbon fuels and technologies. EGCFs play an important transitional role towards net zero emissions. A 2022 CE Delft study found that the use of exhaust gas cleaning systems can result in a lower overall CO2 emissions compared to the refining process required to produce low sulfur fuels. Several credible science-based studies also support the efficacy of these systems and demonstrate that EGCS wash water discharges operate within stringent water quality standards. In summary, Chair, while we share the legislature's environmental objectives, this bill duplicates existing federal and international requirements and could unintentionally discourage the use of internationally authorized equivalent technologies. We urge your committee to recognize our compliance and preserve the use of equivalent technologies approved under these frameworks, including for EGCS. We welcome the opportunity to work with the committee and state agencies to ensure Alaska's policies remain aligned with the established international regulatory framework. Chair, we thank you for your consideration. We're happy to take questions if you have them. And I'm joined on the phone by Ms. Valerie Chatterley for additional specific technical details as may be needed, because I know you heard a lot this evening about EGCS operations.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Black carbon, fuel switching. If we can help answer questions, we'd be happy to do so, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Chatterley, you are also on the list for invited testimony. A limit of 5 minutes, please.
I just concluded with... Hello. Thank you very much. My name is Valerie Chatterley. I am an environmental consultant that has been working with Carnival Corporation and have been assisting with doing risk assessments and managing a world's largest database related to EGCS discharges. And as I said, as Donnie said, I'm here in a supporting role without any testimony, just to answer any specifically science-related questions. Thank you.
Very good. Senator Kawasaki?
Thank you. Yes, on a sort of science-related topic, relating to, I'm just noting that Hawaii has a pretty stringent, probably more stringent than Alaska rules about that 0.1 emission. They use scrubbers, and then it says that within 200 miles of the coast. What does Carnival do then? Do they keep separate fuel to use within that area?
Yes, in our ships that are equipped with AAQS or scrubbers, as they're commonly called, they will be provided with a dual tank, so they can run either with MGO and or HFO. And then, of course, we do have ships that are LNG capable.
Okay.
Further questions? All right, seeing none, thank you, Ms. Chatterley, for being on the phone, and thank you, Mr. Brown, for your testimony. So with that, we will end work on this bill. I'm going to set the bill aside for now, and we will take up the next bill on our agenda. That's Senate Bill 224, Public Land Sale, Lease, Commercial Development. So here with us today to present the bill is Christy Colas, Director, Division of Mining, Land, and Water of the Department of Natural Resources, and Jim Walker, Section Chief, Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for having us here today. For the record, my name is Christy Colas. I am the Director for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. I'm here with my colleague, Jim Walker, who's going to help walk us through the bill and the different components of it. It's a big piece of legislation. We think it's very important, though, for your consideration, as it will help us move a lot of different land projects forward. So I'm going to pass it over to Jim Walker.
Thank you. Through the chair, members of the Senate Resources Committee, as my director indicated, this is a big bill with a lot of component parts. I'd like to, if it meets with the committee's approval, move forward in groups of topics that are addressed in this bill. And first and foremost, this bill contains a lot of housekeeping provisions that are needed to modernize and build efficiencies within our practices at the Division of Mining, Land, and Water and the Department of Natural Resources. For example, with regards to leases, presently as the law is written, if a party wants to lease lands from the state of Alaska, they must perform a full-blown cadastral survey, right, for any type of lease that is made. This can be very onerous to businesses. It can be needlessly costly. And one of the things that this bill does, first and foremost, is it makes that a discretionary call for the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. In other words, the commissioner might look at a particular leasehold project and say, no, we need a full survey as normally required, but they might look at the project and say that is not necessary in this case. If it is later going to be converted to a sale down the road, of course the full-blown survey would be required, but for purposes of the lease, not just yet. I'll give you an example of this. We worked on quite a bit for a period of time, some alternate energy projects, specifically wind farms. And within wind farms, they require a lot of land to be contained within the leasehold. Infrastructure is very limited within that leasehold. They only have the windmills and other infrastructure on a small portion of it. So if you have, say, 1,000 acres tied up with the entire project, maybe only 10 acres are going to be burdened by infrastructure. What this bill would allow us to do is to forego the survey requirement for the entire 1,000-acre parcel, which would make cost prohibitive, but and instead allow them to move forward. If it ultimately does go to sale for any reason, of course, the cadastral survey would be included. The bill does other things with regards to our land sales program. For example, right now, land sales contracts where individual Alaskans buy residential property and they execute a land sales contract with the state. Right now, they have 20 years to pay that off. This bill extends that period to 30 years so that they can have a smaller payment over a longer period of time, so that it makes it more affordable for the average Alaskan to purchase these lands. We also have in this bill modernization of various terminology. For example, the way it's written right now, we talk about foreclosures. Well, the Department of Natural Resources is not a bank. You know, it's to conform the language, it is more termination of a sales contract and things of that nature. In addition to these various housekeeping matters, we also have some specific designations that are addressed, and specifically to remove some administrative burdens with regards to our land, our management of state lands. First, in the last two sections of the bill, we talk about repealing the state statutes for two state game refuges, specifically the Kenai National Moose Range and Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge. Okay? Now, what had happened was originally when these state game refuges were created, they were co-located with the federal refuge. They were exactly the same in terms of their boundaries. Over time, for example, as you see on the map on the left-hand side of the Kenai Refuge, over time, the footprint of the federal refuge contracted. But still, we have the larger, more inclusive boundary for the state game refuge. What this bill would do is remove that overage. Right. This is a bill that is supported by the Department of Fish and Game. I believe that there is someone on call for this conference if you would like to address with them. But it's also something that is strongly supported by the Department of Natural Resources, primarily for two reasons. One, we would like to manage these lands unburdened by the additional restrictions that are not needed. This would allow us, for example, to sell, and if we could go to the next slide, please, a sample of a subdivision within the boundaries of the Kenai State Game Refuge, but is not now included within the boundaries of the National Federal Refuge. So you'll see in this image before you, in blue, that is the boundary that still exists for the State Game Refuge. The yellow, the more contracted boundary is for the federal refuge. And you can see how in red this potential subdivision would be included within this. Over the years, because of the drafting of this bill, there was somewhat of a disagreement regarding whether or not the contraction of the state refuge was automatic with the contraction of the federal refuge. We presently believe that to avoid putting unnecessarily clouds on title of lands that might have already been conveyed through municipal entitlements or other land sales, that this amendment, this codification, this change to the refuge boundaries is indicated. The same situation, albeit a much smaller area of involvement, is for the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge. And again, we see there the blue is the boundary for the legislative designated area. The yellow is the boundary for the National Wildlife Refuge. And then the red depicts an area that would be subject to potential land sales in the area. So that is kind of a conforming amendment that is also addressed in this bill.
Could you pause there for a moment, please? And I just want to ask committee members, does anyone have any questions on what's been shared so far? Senator Wilikowski.
What would be the process for selling that land or disposing of that land if this bill were to pass?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Christy Collis, division director. Senator Wilikowski, so we have to go through a whole public process, a decision that has to be written, and then with final finding and decision that goes out after we've considered all public comments and agency review. And then it can also be appealed to the commissioner. Commissioner can make a decision. It can then go to court. So there's quite a long process that would go through before we can sell any of these parcels.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski? Any further questions? All right. Seeing none, I'll let you proceed.
Thank you. While we are on the subject of what we deem are obsolete land restrictions, we have a situation involving something that is called business park wetlands. For those of you who are in Anchorage, you may be familiar with this. This is a 3-acre parcel of land within the boundaries of the municipality. This was originally created back in the late 1980s and 1990s in an effort to preserve wetlands and wildlife habitat in the growing municipality. What happened was a group called the Business Park Wetlands Coalition came to the legislature, asked for an appropriation, and otherwise raised funds. They took that money, purchased land from the municipality and transferred it to the state to be maintained in perpetuity as wetlands and wildlife habitat. Shortly after all of those events, the Business Park Wetlands Coalition went defunct, and there was no successor in interest. And so we have a situation where it is sitting in the middle of Anchorage. It is also becoming less viable as wetlands. It is still legally wetlands. It is still on their wetlands map. But however, with the building up all around this, it has largely dewatered the area. And what has happened is because of our inability to use this land for any other purpose, it has become an area of homeless encampments. And every year, our division is forced to undertake a contract with various parties to clean up the Business Park wetlands at numerous times. So far, to date, we have spent over $80,000 with contractors to clean up the Business Park wetlands. Our contract for the next 5 years is over $100,000 just to keep up with the drug paraphernalia and the other things that need to be remediated there. What the bill proposes to do is that it would remove this legislative designation from the Business Park wetlands. And we have been in touch with representatives from the municipality, and we have explained the situation to them. And in meetings that took place as recently as last week, there is a lot of enthusiasm within the municipality because they could use these lands for various projects that they have. Not necessarily speaking for the municipality about what they want to do, but various ideas have been floated, all of which are a far better use of the lands than what it is right now. If appropriate, and this is something that the committee and the Alaska legislature is interested in, it may be that amendment is offered that along the lines of what was done with Telephone Hill here in Juneau, these lands could be conveyed directly from the state to the municipality so that they could then begin using these lands in a far better usage than what they are right now.
Thank you very much. Does anyone have questions? You had questions, yes. Senator Usher?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it. So you say that you go in to the area here on this slide and you clean it up. What makes you go into that area and not other areas in the state that need to be cleaned up?
For the record, Christy Collis, through the chair, Senator Rauscher. We do go all over the state to different areas. This one in particular is right in Anchorage in downtown, and so there's a lot of complaints that we receive due to just all of the encampments and how large they can become. And the larger they become, the more dangerous they become. On top of the fact we do have this in the legislation, it is our responsibility, we feel at this point, to try to do something to maintain it. So, yes, we have taken it upon ourselves to continue to pay to clean this area up. We do also go into other areas depending on the complaints we receive or information that we have, but we do have limited staff and funds.
Follow up.
Senator Rauscher.
So thank you. So through the chair, so what makes you not want to go into the Jonesville area and clean that up?
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, we do try to get out to the Jonesville area, but it is much farther away, and it does have a different use than this area. We are working towards having more enforcement in that area, but that will take money, maybe some sort of a memorandum of agreement with another entity. We are working really closely with the Matanuska-Susitna Borough to see if they can help us as well when it comes to enforcement, since it is an area that is pretty far from our main staffing in Anchorage.
Just one more quick follow-up.
Follow-up, Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, but the area has been improved by money from the DNR, and that was in 2006 and 8, I believe. So, but yet it's been ignored ever since it was improved with that money, and the communities are picking up the tabs for that constantly, and they constantly complain. So you say there's lots of complaints for the other one. Well, there's lots of complaints for this one. This was an area you actually put in and improved for people to come to the area. So I guess I'm just trying to understand the difference.
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, we did not make improvements to this area. It was improved by others. The Business Park Coalition, Business Park Wetlands Coalition, before they defunct. We, from what I understand, have not put any kind of infrastructure into this particular area. I understand what you're saying about the Jonesville area. And as I stated, we are working very hard at trying to find solutions for that area. But that use out there is much different. You have people that are camping, that are shooting, that are recreating. This area is definitely, there's not recreating that's occurring. It is just a homeless encampment and drug paraphernalia.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Myers.
Thank you. So just to clarify, if I'm understanding you correctly, effectively, if we can get rid of this provision in state statute, that clears the way to transfer the land to the municipality. The municipality will likely parcel it out to businesses or something else useful, and it will likely no longer be a homeless encampment. So we're not just necessarily, at least in the long term, transferring homeless encampment from the state to the municipality. We're in the long term getting rid of an area where homeless encampment could occur. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, that is correct. That is our goal, is to find a better use for the land other than just being a homeless encampment.
Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
What section of the bill is this?
It is towards the end, section...
Through the chair, for the record, Jim Walker, Senator Wilikowski. This is section 17 of the bill.
Senator Wilikowski.
And just for the public listening, this is what section 17 reads. This is section 2, 3, and 4, chapter 132, SLA 1992 are repealed. So what... Do you have those included in the bill packet? What those are? What are we repealing? Is it just this one section of land, or are there other things you're repealing?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, for the record, Christy Collis, it would just be for these particular, this Business Park Wetlands was called out very specific. It is only to repeal Business Park Wetland designation.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
Could you provide us with Chapter 132, SLA 1992? And so what you're saying is the only thing that Section 17 applies to is this little 3 acres of land in Midtown Anchorage?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes. And we will supply that to you.
Thank you.
Further questions? All right, seeing none, I think you have another slide to go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim Walker, for the record, Alaska Department of Natural Resources. The last provision that this bill includes is the creation of a mechanism for recognizing commercial development parks within the state of Alaska. As I was asked to get involved with this bill, I performed some research to see how other states have treated these types of issues. And in fact, all other 49 states have similar type of legislation. Not exactly the same. It differs from state to state. But they all have a means by which state land can be identified for purposes of drawing new employers to the state and provide certain incentives for them to do so. If you look, for example, at the Forbes 500's most recent assessment of all 50 states for their business friendliness, Alaska ranks last. CNBC did a similar study using different criteria, but a similar study assessing business friendliness. Again, Alaska ranked dead last. This allows the state of Alaska to create a mechanism by which we can identify, cut through red tape, and designate lands that would be suitable for such commercial purposes moving forward. The way this would work under the bill is that lands that have already been classified for settlement purposes, from that, there would be an analysis done to identify areas that would be suitable for industrial and other commercial development. Those would be listed on an inventory. But first, before any of that takes place, there would be a full-blown best interest finding and robust public process to understand that these are good lands with which to have such development and to add potentially new employers to the state. So what we would be doing with this bill, if it passes, is we would be front-end loading a lot of this administrative process so that we would not miss opportunities that would present themselves down the road. Presently, if an employer comes to the Department of Natural Resources and says, I'm interested in relocating here, and I need some land, and it needs to have this or that or whatever, we say, that sounds great. We would love to have you. It's going to take us about 5 years or longer to get a full adjudication of a lease for you or other type of opportunity where you can start your business here in Alaska. In most instances, that employer is going to say, thanks, no thanks. I'm going to go to a state who's going to have greater incentives for us. Under this bill, we would identify those areas, have a robust public process. Again, regulations would have to be promulgated under all of this. That's down the road. But with this enabling statute, we could begin that process of putting together regulations and otherwise developing a robust inventory of lands that would meet this bill to allow us as a state to be nimble and respond to economic opportunities as they arise. The other provisions of these commercial development parks include lease terms of up to 55 years with a renewal option. There is a purchase option for lessees that is also included within this. And there is consideration of economic factors beyond only fair market value as a means for reimbursing the people of the state of Alaska for the use or purchase of these lands. All of those economic factors would be tied to performance benchmarks that encourage business investment and support long-term development goals. Those are some of the highlights of the commercial development parks. And Chair Giesel, if there are any questions about that, I'd be happy to stop on that point before moving on.
Very good. Are there questions? Yes, Senator Wilikowski.
What was the articles that you referenced that said Alaska was the worst, least friendly business place in the country?
I'll be happy to submit those to the...
Yeah, I'd like that.
Absolutely.
And because I'm looking at one, was it CNBC?
I'm looking at the one from, where is it? Yeah, CNBC.
Yeah.
America's Top States for Business 2025, the full rankings.
And one of the things that I'm looking at the study right now, one of the things we got an F at was education. What are you doing to improve education in the administration?
In the department?
Yeah.
Through the chair.
Through the government. I didn't see this listed anywhere in any of the things that they listed.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I'm with the Department of Natural Resources. Okay. I'm not trying to pass the buck here.
I understand.
But okay. I am not with the Department of Education. I'm with the Department of Natural Resources.
Different question. If I could, Madam Chair?
I believe Ms. Colas wanted to comment.
For the record, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think one thing that we could say we were trying to do with this bill is we are trying to put more land in areas and communities where it can be used for business development, as well as subdivisions. And that would help with our population base. The more jobs there are, the more folks would show up or maybe stay. I know we lose people to lower 48. So I do think that this would have a tie in trying to improve our economy. I know it's not the sole fix, but I do think it has a piece in the puzzle when it comes to the lands that we have that we got from the federal government that we're continuing to get from the federal government. We still have about 5 million acres left of remaining entitlement. I do believe this could have a piece in helping us to improve our communities, improve the job market, improve folks wanting to stay here in Alaska for their kids, which I know helps with the economy and the state of Alaska in general. So I hope that it could have a piece in that. Very small.
Senator Wilikowski.
Just a comment and a question. But we also got an F for infrastructure. Do you think the governor vetoing $70 million, which would have leveraged $700 million in federal transportation funds, was a good thing for our F rating?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'm going to decline to comment on the governor's decisions.
Right, thank you.
Probably a rhetorical question. Yeah. Senator Dunbar.
I do have another.
Excuse me, Senator Dunbar. I'll let Senator Wilkowski have one more question.
Yeah. I am curious, though, what – so I'm looking at page 8, lines 5 through 13, about which lands can be designated. Can you describe which lands can be designated for commercial development by the commissioner or by a person? What lands are available? Do you have a map of that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. So we go through a planning process. We have plans across the state. We're getting really close to actually having our most plans for almost all areas of the state. And part of that process is to classify lands. Settlement lands is the lands that we can dispose of, as well as agriculture lands. And so we do identify lands that we can dispose of, identify lands that must retain in state ownership. And so we have about 3,200,000 acres of settlement lands across the state that we could use to as a starting place. If somebody came to us and they're like, hey, this is a really good area, we think you should consider it. If we were to reclassify it, we'd have to go through that decision process that would accompany a decision to whether or not we should even designate that area. But we would start with that 3,200,000 acres that have already been identified.
Just a request, if we could.
Yes, follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
I know in the past you've provided some rough maps, and could you get us some maps of what lands would be available?
Yeah, through the chair. Senator Wilkowski, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you mentioned that 49 other states have these kind of development parks or development economic development zones. My understanding is that these haven't been without controversy in other parts of the country. It's a little bit different, but there's a famous Kelo versus New London decision. That had to do with more private property, but these can cause a lot of controversy. I'm curious what kind of activity are we talking about here? So, in Anchorage, at least right now, we have a large surplus of sort of traditional business real estate. There's a lot of businesses that are empty. We have office buildings that are being underutilized. I think building more of that kind of development might not make sense, at least somewhere like Anchorage. What would make sense are things like manufacturing. We're certainly looking for that. But as I'm reading this, I'm not seeing a lot of sort of controls on what it can be used for, and it seems to put a lot of discretion in the hands of the commissioner. The other thing that I'm curious about is, what if it was a mining project or that kind of resource, traditional resource development? Could the developer work with the commissioner, let's say a commissioner that has in the past, made very low settlements with a large developer, something like that, to get a sweetheart deal? So that's what I'm curious about. What protections are there from the public on what kind of development is produced and on preventing any sweetheart deals from the commissioner's office?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, several questions that you've just asked, and I'll do my best to unpack them individually. And please, if I don't get to one, please remind me. Specifically, your question about have these been widely accepted without controversy elsewhere? Absolutely not. Finding that sweet spot, finding the Goldilocks between protecting the public interest and getting the maximum value for the lands of the state and encouraging business development, finding that sweet spot has always been a challenge. Some states have been more successful than others. Some states, I guess it is in the eye of the beholder, but some states, some folks might believe, have given away the shop in order to attract new industry and whatnot. But what this does specifically is it just identifies the lands, front-end loads the process that can then be used nimbly through various checks and balances that are in here to make sure that what the public is getting in terms of reimbursement for the lease, reimbursement for the sale, actually provides economic value to the state beyond simple fair market value. So tying those economic benchmarks to the cost of the leasehold and the ultimate costs of purchasing the land, I would submit, is something that needs to be hammered out in the regulation. And it needs to be done on a case-by-case basis, subject, of course, to a best interest finding that would be appealable and litigated. So there is that check and balance on all of this. Does it give the department a fair bit of discretion and the commissioner specifically to act opportunistically? Yes, it does. But we need that in order to take advantage nimbly of business opportunities.
Brief follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
Just to put a finer point on my other parts of that question. So could mining or other resource development use this process? And then what can or cannot use this process? You know, is there any restrictions on the kind of commercial activity that could be used through this process?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, for the mining question, that's interesting because I know one of the biggest concerns is how we process material once it's taken out of the ground and getting those minerals out. If somebody wanted to come in and develop a facility that could help with those mining companies to be able to actually process the ore, that might be something that we could consider, which I think is something that the state needs, because otherwise we ship everything out to other countries, states, to try to have it refined. So, yes, I do think that they could actually utilize for those purposes. I think if we were to have any restrictions, we'd want to hammer those out in regulation. We don't have anything currently in the bill. We do have a reversionary clause that we could have that land revert back to us if it's not being used for the purposes in which it was intended. So that way that is one of the stopgaps. And then to the benchmarks, have them getting to the point where they could actually purchase so we can actually see them investing in the land. That's something that we'd be watching. And then if they wanted to purchase, we would let them apply those lease payments towards the purchase price. And that's trying to incentivize them to develop the land for which they intended to develop it, and then give them some sort of a benefit for the money that they've been investing towards that property.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, so I'm looking at this commercial development park, and specifically in Section 12 and 13, talks about this competitive interest demonstrated, and that the commissioner will make all these determinations. But you said there's still a best interest finding requirement. Does that still exist then?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, the best interest finding happens at the very beginning for whether or not it's appropriate to develop this land or to offer this land for commercial use. With the commissioners deciding between two applicants, that would be a separate decision process of who's the more qualified applicant, but not whether or not the land is appropriate for commercial development.
So clarify.
Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
If both of them wanted to do the same thing, or are you saying that one could have a preference to the other, or is it just that when a best interest finding is there, it's just that there's vacant land, it should be used for something? I guess that's really what I'm trying to drill down on.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I think, so let me just back up a bit. So the best interest finding is we have settlement land. Let's say we have 40,000 acres. 20,000 acres, I don't know, 10,000. And we're going to say, okay, now we're going to do a best interest finding. And we're going to say this 10,000 acres, we're going to offer, and we're going to say whether or not it's appropriate for commercial use. We'll go through a decision process that goes out to the public and agencies. And then we take all those comments. We do a final decision that would say, yes, this is appropriate for us to move forward with this commercial parks. It'd be kind of our portfolio at that point to companies to say, hey, we have 10,000 acres. It's already been through the decision process. It didn't get challenged in court. And then if two applicants came to us and they're like, hey, we want 500 acres right here, and they both want the same property, then it would have to be a decision by the commissioner between those two applicants and their business plan.
Okay. So, and it could be
follow-up, Senator Kawasaki.
A different proposal. One could say we want to build housing, and then the other person could say they want to build a super mall or whatever. And then that decision would rest solely with the commissioner.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, yes, it wouldn't go out for public comment at that point. It would be more of an internal decision by the commissioner. And that would be something that would also need to be kind of hammered out through regulations on what that looks like. So the applicants knew what was going to be vetted when they were being considered.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Myers.
Thank you. My question got answered.
All right. Senator Kawasaki, or excuse me, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Okay, so the commission, so this says the commissioner can designate state land as a commercial development park. The public, then it goes out for public notice. There's a finding it's in the best interest, and that's it. That's all the public involvement there is. Does the commissioner have to say what the commercial development park is at the time that he sends it out for public notice? Does he have to say it's going to be a housing development, or does he have to be specific, or does he just have to say, or she have to say, well, no, we're just doing a commercial development park?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the idea is not to be too specific. Specific enough that the public knows what's happening, but we've had a lot of interest that comes to us with different ideas, right? And we might think that one thing might be better housing in this area versus some other manufacturing operation. But really, it's going to be the businesses coming to us, telling us what it is they're interested. I think part of the decision process is hearing from the public. What do they have concerns about being in this area? Maybe we would limit it based off of the public input, agency input. There might be parameters that we'd have to set out. And so maybe it wouldn't fit certain businesses based off of those parameters. But it is kind of setting it up ahead of time so that way when businesses come to us, we can give them, here's the land, here's what's available, here's some of the sideboards that you must follow if you're going to consider this land. We could go out if we have a lot of applicants. Maybe we would go out and notice it. But it wouldn't. We're trying to get away from the full decision process because right now I'm telling companies when they come to us, yeah, best bet 2 years if I don't get appealed, if we can even do it, and then we could go to court, and then I can't tell you. I mean, I have some things tied up in court for a very long time, and so we're just trying to make it where the public knows this is an industrial area we'd like to develop, and that way businesses can also know when they come to us what's available.
Just a comment.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
And I'll just say the description, what you are describing is not the way the bill's written. It doesn't require any specificity. It just says commercial development park, no specificity required. Maybe there's a regulation. Maybe the commissioner says there what the specificity level is, but that is not required in the statute. Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, thank you for pointing that out. I think that's how we envision it based off of kind of how we've been talking. And that would be something we would hammer out in regulation. And just to be honest, through public comments and agency comments, we do a lot of changes to proposals. So that's how I kind of, that's, I think, why I envision it that way.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah. And then, so at what point does a municipality, if it's in a municipal confined boundaries, what time do they decide like, oh, well, we don't want you guys to do that here because they've figured out they wanted to do it, you know, do something else. I mean, is there any input by the municipal government?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, the municipal government a lot of times gets involved during the public notice portion. So if they had really big concerns about it being a commercial park, we would consider their opinions. And of course, we have to consider zoning as well. You know, for our subdivisions, for example, they can require that we have to build roads. And so we do follow those zoning requirements.
Further questions? Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Not a question, just a thing to add to the list was the two parcels that are in the Kenai Moose Refuge and the Kodiak whatever refuge. I don't know those areas. That's not really my area. But I want to know if there's certain rules that would apply to that area that would now be gone if that repealer in Section 16 goes through. Like, are there certain protections for the animals and now there's not going to be if those are repealed? So that's for a later conversation.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki will do that.
Great. Thank you. And I would appreciate you, yes, answering these questions. Send them forward to my office. We'll distribute them to the committee. Okay. So thank you for being here and presenting the bill. So that concludes our meeting. As announced by my staff last week, There is an amendment deadline for HB 33, Conflict of Interest, Board of Fisheries and Game, for this Friday, March 13th at noon. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday, March 11th at 3:30. At that time, we're going to have a presentation on the Rail Belt Transmission Update by Curtis Thayer with the Alaska Energy Authority, and a presentation on the Port of Alaska Energy Project by Terry Amaton, the Port Director. At this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 5:03 p.m.